Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
So government in Jamaica has been very slow, sometimes crippled by bureaucracy, crippled by politics, and in that regard, I would say crippled by a politics of poverty. What do I mean by the politics of poverty? It is a sense of the historical struggle of Jamaica, where the large mass of people feel disenfranchised, coming out of a colonial system, a plantation system, where a few people control the wealth and the rest of the people had no possessions. And that has translated into the modern Jamaican society, with Jamaica having one of the highest levels of income inequality. Few people control all of the wealth, and the majority of people have very low incomes. And that sets a stage within the context of a democracy of a struggle for equality, a struggle for equity in the society.
Okay, hello, good evening, everyone. I have a question for, I believe, Prime Minister Holness or Minister Tufton could take this one. So given that it's now public knowledge of Usain Bolt's positive COVID-19 status, can the ministry confirm that rigorous contact tracing procedures are being carried out for him and the other public figures that are present at the event? And how are authorities treating with the allegation that some of the public figures who were recently overseas and attended did not abide by or complete the mandatory 14-day quarantine orders? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Brittany. As you have said, it is now public knowledge that Mr. Bolt has been tested positive. He has been formally notified, I'm told, by the authorities. And in keeping with standard protocols, once there is a positive case, irrespective of the individual, it triggers an approach to questioning, interrogation, if you will, which would then follow through with contact tracing. So the answer to your question would be yes, the process would have started. As it relates to the second part of the question about public figures coming in, I am not aware. I don't have specifics of any particular individual coming in and breaching the orders for quarantining. However, what I will say is that we do not discriminate depending on the person. The rules apply to everyone. And to the extent that we have information, then the rules would apply in this case, or any other case for that matter.
Thank you, Minister. I mistook
just
Edmund
to, just
for...
Just to say that the police, as I've said earlier in my presentation, just to back up what Minister Tufton is saying, the police are investigating. They are looking into all aspects of the matter. So no one is going to be treated with any exemption or any... given any special treatment. All Jamaicans have a duty, and of course, those who have the public ear and have influence in public spheres, they have an even greater duty.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Wednesday, August 26th, 2020. So I have been told, wow, the wackiness of this year continues. They have a so-called boycott of NBA playoff games. This is one where words and details are important. This is all regarding the police shootings that have continued to take place. Mr. Blake in Wisconsin, who did live, thankfully this was not a fatal shooting, but they've continued to have protests and what have you, even fatal protests in Wisconsin. So the Milwaukee Bucks players decided not to play their game today. It's been rescheduled. Wowee. What times it is on the plantation globally, system of racism, white supremacy. Our broadcast for today, I think, was somewhat influenced. So last month, we had Dr. Tyler Perry as a guest on the program, and we discussed his fascinating research, the use of hounds in the system of white supremacy racism. And he talked about how this was a global effort, that they used hounds throughout the Caribbean and shared this knowledge. Nigger dogs, that was my new term, but this was shared throughout the Caribbean and the Americans to control black people for years. Profitable international enterprise, nigger dogs. Jamaica was mentioned, Cuba, fascinating. You can go back and listen to that with Dr. Tyler Perry. So I think a few days after that, one of our listeners was saying, hey, you should check out this author's work. Great information on how the CIA destabilized Jamaica in the 1970s. The article should be linked in the description for the program. You can check it out. Great read. Will not take you all day long. It's one of those, you know, 5 minutes. Great read. It might even inspire you to read a little bit more. As I was checking out the information for that report and digging in to just see more of his research interests, I saw that he also authored a book, Drug War Pathologies, Embedded Corporatism and U.S. Drug Enforcement in the Americas. Also, I thought, fascinating, seems to be related somewhat and deals with white supremacy racism, so I thought we would include that in the discussion, the audio segment that you heard at the beginning. Income inequality. The Prime Minister of Jamaica, Andrew Holness, talking about the legacy of colonialism, white supremacy, and how that continues to influence the thinking, behavior of people in Jamaica, and income inequality. That comes up quite a bit in some of our guests' research. And then we heard Prime Minister Holness discussing COVID-19. That was just this week. Man, I had about 8 double takes. Usain Bolt, fastest male in the world, all the Olympic, you know, fame and glory that he's obtained in his career. I looked at it, I think, for like Monday. It said Usain Bolt, birthday bash, all this. And then, like, within the same week, it said Usain Bolt, COVID-19, positive. And I said, wait a minute, am I looking at this wrong? Like, birthday? And I had to keep looking and keep looking and keep looking. Oh, okay, so it was a birthday party. And then, man, COVID-19's impact worldwide. Definitely wanted to at least take a moment to see what the impact has been in Jamaica, tourism, all that, how they're dealing with this pandemic globally. What times worldwide 2020. Our guest, in addition to all of the books, reports that he has authored, he is a professor of international political economy at the University of Kentucky, a member of the National Security Archives for over 25 years. We're thankful he could share a bit of his Wednesday afternoon or evening with us. Joining us live, our guest, Dr. Horace Bartolo. Dr. Bartolo, are you with us, sir?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you for sharing a bit of your time and insight. So glad to get an opportunity to hear more about your research. For our listeners, this might be their first time hearing from you. Just if you'd like to give a little bit more about who you are, the work that you do.
I think you covered it pretty well. But yes, I'm a political economist. I examine the relationships between political decisions and their economic outcomes, and how economic outcomes and decisions have political consequences. So as a political economist, we're quite different from straight political scientists or even economists, because we factor in our analysis the role of both how politics shape economics and vice versa.
For folks who have not seen you, you are a black male, is that correct?
Yes, the last time I checked.
Just for a little bit of detail, we'll get to your reports and such as we roll, but with the National Security Archives, just can you give us a little bit more details about what that organization does, what you've been doing for over 25 years?
Yeah, I've been working with the National Security Archives, you know, from even before I got out of graduate school. I spent a lot of time there, you know, getting declassified documents. I use a lot of declassified documents in my research from either the graduate student, my dissertation. It's an organization that's based in Washington, D.C. It's housed at the University of George Washington University. So that's one, you know, one archive. And there's also the National Archive of the U.S. government, that I also do a lot of, work, in digging up, declassified documents. And of course, you know, some documents are available at presidential libraries, you know, that they make available to the public, you know, memorandums and things of that like, that nature. So I encourage all of your viewers, you could subscribe and become members of the National Security Archive. They will send you email notifications of newly released documents. Some of these documents you might find, your viewers might find interesting, but these documents really put a new light on things that we thought that we knew, but certainly not true. So it's very important that the American people and people in general have a very clear view of their history, and one of the best ways of knowing that is by keeping your pulse on newly released documents, because you know governments will do lie, and years later these documents are released, and you'll know what motivated certain behavior. So that's very important, a very important part of my research. But it's not the only part of my research. I'm also trained in econometrics. So not only, you know, the declassified documents will take you so far, but they don't answer other questions. You know, this is where you need to collect you know, real hard statistical data and run statistical analysis. When the statistical analysis agrees with or supports the archival stuff, and then you know that your research finding is very, very robust, because you get the same results by using two different methods. So I am considered to be a mixed methods person. In other words, I use multiple methodologies in social science to produce results that tend to be robust. And it's very, you know, it's very hard, if not impossible, to challenge that kind of a research, because, you know, if you're getting similar results by using quite different methods, then you know, in other words, you know, no matter how you study something, it's not the research design or the methods that is biasing the results. You know, the results are the results. So we could study a thing 10 different ways and we're going to get the same results, which tells us that the results are robust.
Context of white supremacy. You were actually born in Jamaica, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And I guess at what age did you come to the States?
I came to the States in my 20s, early to mid-20s, I think, yeah. More early 20s, I came to the States for college. And that there's a story behind how I came to the States, a story that I had forgotten, to be honest with you. I grew up in Jamaica, and you know, my sense of politics came of age in the 1970s with Michael Manley government. Both my parents were election workers, what we call in Jamaica at the time, they were returning officers. Actually, my mother was the returning officer for the then National Minister of National Security, Mr. Dudley Thompson. My father was the returning officer for Prime Minister Michael Manley. I remember quite well that, what returning officers basically did, they were employed by the Jamaican electoral office. And they basically make sure that, the voters lists in the constituencies that they're assigned to are up to date, that, that voting is fair, that there are no shenanigans going on in voting itself, and they follow the rules, election laws of the country. Both my parents were brutally attacked in the run up to the 1980 elections. I, at the time, I think my last year of high school, I was planning to go to the University of West Indies. I had no intention of coming to study in the United States. You know, I was an only child, so I really wasn't wanting for anything. I really loved living in Jamaica. But after that, I saw my mother bandaged it up. And she spent 2 months in the hospital. A group of men surrounded their car when they were coming out of one of the polling stations. One of the young men threw a rock inside the windshield that bloodied them. My mom was in the hospital for about 2 months, recovering from eye surgery to take glass fragments out of her eye. I remember the day when the police came and got me out of school and took me to the hospital to see them. Weeks after that, I remember that our house was graffiti with a sign saying, "Socialist dogs must die." And a group of people came in front of my house, screaming and yelling at my parents. And it was after that point, I got a soccer scholarship to come to the United States, which I didn't intend to take because I said I didn't want to come to the United States. And after that, my parents said, I think you really should go. It was at a 2-year community college upstate New York. I didn't want to. That's not what I wanted to do. But they were really insisting. They didn't want to frighten me or scare me. Now, I'm telling you all of this because all of this memory that I just told you, I had forgotten about it completely. The memory came back to me about a year and a half ago when I was teaching my American foreign policy class here at University of Kentucky, and we were discussing the Mueller investigation and the Mueller report of Russian interference in American election. And I had like a memory, all this memory that I didn't know that I had rushed into my brain, and I felt a little bit off. And I had to call a friend of mine after this incident to find out if I was actually hallucinating or, you know, these were false memories. And he said, no, don't you remember? And the more he told me, the more all this stuff came back. And that is what led me to say, you know what, I should really go do a thorough investigation of what happened in Jamaica in the 1970s. There was a lot of talk at the time. I remember growing up about CIA involvement, but there were no conclusive evidence of that at the time, at least as far as I you know, I knew or I read about. And then as I started to dig into this stuff at the National Security Archives, you know, the more I found evidence that this was not inconclusive, that this wasn't just circumstantial, but there was a systematic, very extensive U.S. covert operation to destabilize the Jamaican government of Michael Manley. I begin to dig beyond that. Why was this? The prevailing paradigm was that, of course, if the United States was involved, and we have gotten past that now, not a question of if, it's why. So the argument was, if the United States was involved, it was because of the Cold War, right? They saw Manley as being communist, and the United States had to defend its so-called backyard, which, you know, we could break that down a bit. And then the more I dig into that to find out, well, you know, was it really communism that they were afraid of? And I found more evidence, more documents that, no. In fact, they didn't even see Manley as a communist. They had multiple reports. First, they asked British MI6, because, United States CIA, many times they work with the British in covert operations in the Caribbean, especially the English-speaking Caribbean. They asked British MI6 for a psychological profile of Manley, and the British came back and said, well, you know, Manley is actually, if anything, he's a foolish and naive leader, but he's certainly no Marxist, he's certainly no revolutionary. The State Department...
Can we pause for kind of a moment, kind of set up a little bit just with, in case there are folks listening who don't really know who Michael Manley is, and even just to appreciate that, because I think that's so important, that piece of history, that portion from your life, your parents being attacked and you repressing that memory, and even have someone else have to say, hey, don't you remember, man, this happened, and yeah, your parents, and this influenced even how you ended up in the U.S., because I think that happens to a lot of black people worldwide, a lot of victims of white supremacy, where we end up just totally repressing these type of incidents, this type of terrorism that happens to us.
Yes,
even just with that incident, I guess, what exactly, you said your parents were helping to make sure that the elections were operating correctly and people were, you know, able to vote, go out and vote in a just manner. Why were people upset and attacking them?
Well, are you prepared to hear this extensive answer to that?
Well, we'd like to cover as much as possible, so, you know.
All right. Okay. So let me go back a bit. One of the documents that I came across from, it's a National Security Council document. Right, these are the folks in the U.S. National Security that actually approve covert operations overseas. This was a memorandum by Robert Pastor. He was assistant. He was the assistant to Brzezinski, who was President Carter's national security advisor. And Robert Pastor, and I wrote about this in the Gleaner, in the Saturday, the Observer article. He lists a summary of what the CIA's proposal in Jamaica. And it was to finance the GLP, the opposition in GLP. Right? This is the party that's now running Jamaica. And finance the Gleaner, which is the conservative paper, provide finance and advise the opposition leader Edward Siega, and finance the Christian Democratic Union, which is a German centrist Christian right party. It's the party that is now headed by Angela Merkel. So I'm going to put some pieces together for you. Okay, that's why I said it's very extensive and very sophisticated. The question is, why finance the Christian Democratic Union to come to Jamaica to be observers, to be election observers? Well, the reason was that CIA attempted to block Manley's re-election in 1976, and they failed. He won tremendously. And since 1976, there was an onslaught of propaganda in the Gleaner that by after 1976, the CIA was now fully funded and controlled the Gleaner. But you know, I did a Gleaner archival research and collected data on anti-Manley government messages and editorials in the Gleaner. One of them, there are many of them. One is the communist theme, Cuban takeover, Soviet takeover. One of them was election fraud. They claimed that Manley won in 1976 based on election fraud. Okay? Part of the election fraud was they used my mother as a poster child of the Manley government's election fraud. How? Well, after 1976 and the run up to the 1980 elections, returning officers are starting to get a new voters list. In the constituency that my mom was the election returning officer for, it was the Minister of National Security, a man by the name of Dudley Thompson. Dudley Thompson also was a very well-renowned Pan-Africanist, by the way. The racial aspect of this is right there. But anyway, they wanted to undermine the credibility of Mr. Thompson. Okay? And so what the Jamaica Labor Party did is that they had a lot of people with the name Thompson to contest the seat. Now, my mother, and what I was reading in the newspapers, right, she stopped most of these people from basically registering to contest the seat because they did not have proper identification. right? You can't test for, you can't offer yourself as a candidate in an election without proper identification. And she was reamed in the CIA now controlled Gleaner. I have the evidence myself. I mean, right? She was identified by a lot of the editorial people. They called her by name, that she was basically a stooge for the Mandy government. And so what they basically did was to put a target on her back. And, of course, weeks later, she was attacked. Now, the question is, well, why did they do that? Well, they did that. This is a larger picture, right? There's a small picture and there's a larger picture. So you have to bear with me. They did that because that was a setup for a possible military coup d'etat should Manley win in 1980. And I'm going to show you all these little pieces of the puzzle fit together. Okay? We know from in 1973 when the CIA overthrew or financed the coup of Salvador Allende in Chile, that one of the things that they did before the coup was to undermine the credibility of Allende's Minister of Security. And so what that did is that you begin to push the military away from civilian leadership. That is what they were trying to do in Jamaica as well. And my mother was simply collateral damage. Now, let's roll up to 1980. The Christian Democratic Union was financed by the CIA to come to Jamaica as election observers. Why the Christian Democratic Union of Germany? Well, I did some more digging, and this is what I found. During the Cold War, and this is a CIA document, this is not me making this up, CIA declassified documents. During the Cold War, the Christian Democratic Union was a CIA front political organization. They worked with the CIA for the purpose of, as a counter the Socialist International, led by the time, led at that time by the man called Willy Brandt, right? The argument was Socialist International was a threat to U.S. strategic interests in the world, because it was, and Socialist International, by the way, was the conglomeration of democratic socialist parties and governments throughout the world, and they were the main ones that was pushing for nuclear disarmament, nuclear strategic talks with the Soviet Union to reduce nuclear weapons. The CIA saw Socialist International as a strategic threat to U.S. global interests. And so they wanted to basically use Christian Democratic parties throughout the world, not just in Germany, but in Italy, in Latin America, in Europe, to be this counterweight against Socialist International. So now they're bringing this German Christian Democratic Union party members to be election observers in Jamaica in an election that is being contested by a democratic socialist government. So here is the counterfactual. If Manley had won in 1980, the Christian Democratic Union, as election observers, would say it was based on fraud, bogus voting, and it would be believed by the Jamaican people, because 4 years before that, the Gleaner was constantly pounding the pavements, seed in the ground. Manley won in 1976 based on election fraud. Election fraud. Election fraud. Election fraud. So if he won in 1980, the Christian Democratic Union would say election fraud, and that would be the signal that the military would take over Jamaica. That would be the signal. Eddie Ciaga, months before the election in 1980, I have him in the newspapers saying, if the PNP wins in the upcoming 19 election, he said, it is going to be blood in the street. That's a signal that had Manley won, there would have been a military coup d'etat. So that's how all that come together.
Context of white supremacy. Our guest, Dr. Horace Bartolo, the report that we've been talking about, the old school trap PM Holness fell into on Manley. And just making sure that I grasp this in a proper context, this is the context of white supremacy. The CIA documents that they went in, you found documents that they went into Jamaica, funded newspaper organizations to speak against, oppose Prime Minister Manley.
Propaganda.
To oppose Prime Minister Manley. He cheated, and
right.
He was not elected justly, and even officials like your mother, your parents, really, who are just out trying to make sure the elections are being done correctly because they are not allowing individuals to register who don't have proper documentation, seeming like this might also be a part of that CIA-funded opposition propaganda of Manley. They end up attacking her. Collateral damage, you called it. They do all of this. He still wins in 76 and then fails in 1980, and it seems like they had a backup plan, even if he had one, in 1980 for a military intervention and or even stronger calls that he cheated. And I want to step back to read a little bit from your report, because in my view, all of this is white supremacy racism at its core, the CIA activity. You write, the declassified documents show that American policymakers in the State Department were concerned about how Manley's democratic socialism in Jamaica highlighted class distinctions and empowered black people on the island, which they feared could spread to the rest of the Caribbean. And this problem, according to the U.S. Embassy, could remain long after Manley was gone. Therefore, the anti-communist narrative became a convenient cover to kill off the long-term threat that black empowerment represented to U.S. policymakers in the region. Any extra details? Go ahead.
And there's more to that, too. You know, since I've written that article, I've learned more to that. This notion of black empowerment or fear of black empowerment was part of the Kennedy administration. So there's a couple of weeks ago I came across a document as early as 1962 or something like that. This is during the Kennedy administration. And the document talks about U.S. policy towards the West Indies. It didn't say Caribbean because a lot of these countries weren't even independent yet. And in that document, American policymakers already were making plans about how they were going to handle independent black countries in the Caribbean before they even existed. Right, and what they wanted their interests, how they wanted these the American interests to be protected in these countries. One main thing they said is that when these countries become independent, we didn't want these black countries to become dependent on us financially. All we want them to be is to basically be good hosts to our military bases. They said, they went on to talk about the different things that they feared could happen. They said, number one fear, they feared that these countries may develop an anti-white sentiment. They said that. they feared that these countries might develop an anti-white sentiment. They went on to say a lot of their leaders, young leaders, might travel to the United States and see and experience racism. And maybe bitter about that and develop an anti-white sentiment. You have a thing that they said? Fear of black nationalism. Right? This is 1962. Long before Jamaica and many of these countries ever became independent. Right? When you get to the 1970s, and now you have Michael Manley bringing in empowering black people with his social policies, providing funding, having a social program that allow black people to go to universities and get university degrees free. The black middle class in that time expanded. Jamaica became very strong in dealing with white American corporate executives in the bauxite industry. This is not something that would be tolerated in the white supremacy mindset. Absolutely not. And so yes, communism became a convenient ploy to kill off what really, really bothered them, which is the notion of black people. And you see this theme coming up over and over again. You know, they talk about, for example, they name certain government ministers of government in Manley's cabinet that they feared. One of them was Tony Spaulding. They said he's a black power militant. D.K. Duncan, black power militant. Arnold Bertram, black power militant. They were meeting with certain moderates in the party, secretly, with the U.S. ambassador, Geer, I think at the time, to get people like, his name was Eric Bell, to try and isolate these black nationalists, they call Marxist black power leaders from influencing Manley's foreign policy and domestic politics. So that's very clear. You know, one of the things that they said is that Jamaica's influence in the world is bigger than its size. Right? If you go on, I quoted a State Department document that said that they were concerned that Jamaica's aggressive and confidence foreign policy could be a problem for us in other places of the world. So the racial dynamic of this is certainly there, and that in my view and from the evidence that I've seen was the driver of the so-called communist, anti-communist attitudes. So anti-communism and racism were inextricably linked during the Cold War. Inextricably linked. You can't separate the two when you're dealing with countries of color.
I've come to the conclusion, just because we heard a lot of this, we read Paul Robeson, Dr. Gerald Horn's biography on Paul Robeson, and then we just were reading about Dr. Martin Luther King, and pops up in a lot of different books, and that'll be so consistent where they will accuse a black person of being a communist, and that will be grounds to mistreat and abuse them. And even Paul Robeson, who was a law student, asked, Well, what's a communist? Explain it, and then I can, you know, properly answer your question about whether or not I am one. And you would have a hard time even getting a definition for what exactly is a communist. Speaking of definition, even I want to make sure I include before we move too far forward, this broadcast, The Cows, Context of White Supremacy, I have concluded what we are talking about, global systems, CIA deliberately destabilizing black people in the area of the world known as Jamaica, doing things to disrupt their efforts to be so-called sovereign. All of that is a part of the global system of white supremacy racism. I use the term racism and white supremacy as synonyms. I use the same definition for both terms. That definition is a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
Yes, I think your definition is accurate. But I also think that it is also more nuanced, right? It is also a little bit more nuanced. For me, I don't exclude the important role of class in this. Class, in other words, racism has really never existed outside of a class structure, right? It is not just simply race by itself. Yes, race is very important and necessary, but we won't fully understand how the system of oppression works if we exclude the class dimension. Okay, so let me I talk about this in the recent book, but let me talk about it a little bit in a different way, in the context of we're talking about the CIA. So I recently again came across more information, more documents. At some point, you know, I'm going to have to stop and I mean, I've started to write, but you know, it's like the more I dig, is the more I find, and you say to yourself, where does this rabbit hole end? So let's fast forward now to 1982. 80 Siaga is now prime minister. Manley has been discredited. He's booted out. And the executive director of the CIA is he writes a memorandum to the director of the CIA, who at the time is a man by the name of William Colby. And in the memorandum, he says, Bob Gates, which is Robert Gates, who became director of the CIA and was also appointed by the Obama administration as well. He says, Bob Gates and I were musing about what a black hole Central America is. We're just pouring a lot of money in Central America we don't see any results, right? This is the time of the Reagan administration, and they're trying to stop the Contras. I mean, they're financing the Contras against the Nicaraguan Sandinistas, right, in Nicaragua. And it says, you know, what did we do in Jamaica? He said, quote, after we won Jamaica, you hear what he said? After we won Jamaica from Manley and gave it to Siaga, we walked away from him. And, you know, let him try to handle a bad economic situation on his own. He says, why did we walk away from Jamaica? We could have supportive, get behind Siega, and show people in the region, of course, black people in the region, the benefits you could get by being friendly to the United States. And they have in the margin, in handwriting in the margin, they're spending $150 million a year in Nicaragua. So the question now is, why do they walk away from Siega? It's true, they don't really support Siega. That's, you know, the part of the title of the book is Betrayal.
Pause for one second, Dr. Bartolo, because the question that I asked, I thought it was going to be kind of a concise example, but this is seeming longer. So when I asked my definition, I want to emphasize, I am not talking about race. I'm talking about white supremacy racism as a global system, not race as a component. That's one. The second thing, when we talk about class, hang on 1 second, because I want to get your response, because this is important. We normally would not have got this far into a program without the definition, because I tell people, as Mr. Fuller says, if you don't understand white supremacy racism, everything else will confuse you. And I found when talking to people, if we don't, at least if I don't have an understanding of, do they think there is a system of white supremacy racism? I at least need to know that before talking to them, because things don't make sense often if I don't get that at least cleared up. So with the class component, because that comes up so much, even with the examples that you have given, are any of these people that are in positions, the CIA director, executives at the CIA, are any of the folks that are making these decisions non-white people?
If they're non-white people?
Are any of the folks at the CIA...
No, they're not.
I'm sorry? Are they non-white people?
No. The people in the CIA that are making these decisions, no. Most of them are white.
Okay. Yes. Well, hang on one second. Because the other component, I'm going to read directly from your book, because I got a lot of quotes from that one as well. Drug War Pathologies: Embedded Corporatism and U.S. Drug Enforcement in the Americas. So you have a chapter and you talk about the elite's role in this. Now, in my view, the elites would be the white race to themselves. If we talk about class, if there is a system of white supremacy that exists worldwide, whites constitute a class to themselves. And I would read your sentence or paragraph, excuse me, you write, according to C. Wright Mills, the power elite, or what Dom Ho calls the American upper class, comprises unified members of an upper social caste whose shared values and psychological affinity for one another are shaped by their ideological indoctrination through the social institutions, in parentheses, prep schools, Ivy League colleges, exclusive social clubs, and interclass marriages. All of that would support what I just said. White people are a class to themselves, and the evidence is as thick as you talked about with the National Archives of all those areas of people activities, Ivy League schools period mostly, marriages, social clubs, businesses, excluding black people. Even if you immigrate here, you can become white and Jewish, Italian, all the way, and move right on into being white, except not the Negro. Yeah. So what I'm saying, is it logical white people would constitute a class to themselves?
Well, no.
That's not logical?
It's not a question of is it logical. Let me explain this. Let me explain something to you. All right. At the time when C. Wright Mills was writing, right, certainly you could say, you know, this is a power elite, and these are white people, right? But even then, a whole lot of white people are not part of that elite, right? It's a ruling class whites, and many other whites are not part of that elite. You know, your trailer park white is not a part of that elite. Absolutely not. Now, you said, are any of these people in the CIA making these decisions at the time, were they white? No. Most of them were, but that's beside the point. They had a lot of black people working for them on their payroll, not only in Jamaica, but around the world. Right? So we shouldn't lose sight of that fact. So, you know, this is not just simply a color thing, right? I know this is where it gets complicated, right? So you're right that yes, white supremacy is a global phenomenon. It has been a global phenomenon ever since the time Europeans basically decided that they're going to colonize the non-white world. It is a global phenomenon. But even at that period of its ascendancy globally, okay, white elites are very distinct from non-white elites. They're very distinct from non-white elites. As you read that,
who are some of the non-white elites? I'm sorry for interrupting. Just who, if you could give us like names, who are some of the non-white elites in the world?
Well, they're the people who at your mom and pa shop, right? They are a lot of your disaffected, out of work, working class whites in the Midwest that blame all their problems on black people.
Oh, wait a minute, Dr. Bartolo.
Why do they blame all
some of the non-white elites? The non-white elites.
Oh, non-white elites.
Yes, sir.
Well, okay. Well, non-white elites. Well, there are a bunch of them in my own country, in Jamaica. Certainly Eddie Siega and the Jamaican ruling class are certainly non-white elites, and many of them are black people, dark as I am. Not all of them, Jamaica is, of course, is an interracial class of white and black people. So that would constitute them. In some countries, other scholars refer to them as the comprador class. That is to say, it's a class of people in a country whose affinity, whose cultural affinity and political affinity and loyalty are to the ruling class whites in Europe and in the United States, and also ruling class non-whites as well. Absolutely.
You said
so. This is not just simply a color thing. That's
okay.
The point I'm getting at. It's not just simply a color thing.
I just want to pause right there. What you're saying, that's why I said I would normally get that at the very beginning. What you just said means you do not agree.
Mm-hmm.
I have concluded it is a color thing worldwide. That's what I mean when I say system of white supremacy. If you don't agree, that's fine. It's important. I have to know that when I'm talking to somebody, because that is enormous, that I'm talking to somebody who does not think we have a global system of white supremacy.
No, there is a global system of white supremacy.
The way I'm giving my definition for white supremacy racism, all of the individuals who practice racism, white supremacy, are white. What you are talking about, these non-white people, the non-white so-called elites, all of these people are victims. And the way I try to use logic, number one, the first thing I looked at Edward Siega. Are you sure he's non-white?
Mm-hmm.
Am I looking at the right person? Is he kind of a pale? But like, he's not like your complexion, Eddie Siega. He's not your complexion, right?
No.
Okay, but you say he's a black. He's a black male.
Yeah, but they're. I don't want to call their names on the radio show. But there are black people dark as I am, right now in the Jamaican government, that were worked for the CIA.
I'm sure that's the case. There are black people. There are black people all the way back to the plantation who work for white. In fact, I'm not sure you can point to a non-white person, if there is a system of white supremacy, I'm not sure you can point to a non-white person who truthfully can say, oh, no, I don't listen to white people at all. I don't listen to them. I don't follow any of their directions. Anything that they say, I don't listen to. Passport, I go anywhere I want to in the world. I don't need a passport. I can do what I want. I don't listen to their financial recommendations or what have you, whatever they say the dollar is worth. I don't listen to that. I don't know any non-white people who can say that. But I do. I just want to get, because you bring this point out in your book.
I'm not following you.
I understand.
I'm not following you.
I understand totally. Let me go to your book, because we don't have agreement about non-white people who somehow support racism, white supremacy. You're saying that they're non-white elite, and I'm saying that these people are just victims. In your book, you talk about the Congressional Black Caucus. I'll just pivot to your book, because you talk about the Congressional Black Caucus in your book, right? Okay. Let's pivot to that.
The Congressional
Black Caucus. I'll read the passages you have. This is from his book about the drug war. That's why I say I normally get that at the very beginning. Is there a system of racism? If that's not the case, that's good to get at the very beginning before we move forward. Many people talk about racism, white supremacy, but definition and the details.
Your show, you're doing a lot of the talking, but I'm listening, sir.
I want to get to the context of your book, because we'll just go back and forth with the definition of the. You don't agree with my definition. I totally get it. Can we please pivot to the book? You don't agree with my definition. That's fine.
It's not that I don't disagree with it. I think it is quite limited, and I don't think it's
that's what
rooted
I'm saying.
In any.
You
any,
don't
any,
agree.
Any,
it's no,
any
it's
known
no,
literature,
sir,
any known research,
sir. You don't agree.
That, right?
That's
is,
all
I
we
mean,
have
is,
to say. Can we
your,
pivot to something
your
else?
Definition.
That's right. That's what I said. It's
right?
my
it's definition.
Dr. Bartolo. Yeah. We got it. You don't agree with my definition. That's all you have to say. We have lots of people who come on the program who do not agree. It's no problem. We just need to make sure that that's clear. We got it. You don't agree with my definition of white supremacy, racism, and there are many others. Now, pivoting and
Can you hang on a second?
Because I want to get to the book. Please, just let me get to the book.
You make it sound so simplistic.
Get to the book. I know. You don't agree. I get it. You don't agree. Can we please get to the book? Thank you. I have allowed you to talk. And you're interrupting me a lot. I have allowed you to talk, and you're interrupting me a lot. I'm trying to get to the book. Thank you. In your book, you focus quite a bit on the Congressional Black Caucus. This would be another example of maybe these are non-white elites. You write, E-Bill, the bill toughened, this is talking about the crime bill, drug wars, 1990s, circa 1990s. The bill toughened prohibition against drug trafficking by adding the death penalty in certain instances and created the Office of National Drug Control Policy, which established for the first time the so-called drug czar. After President Reagan signed the bill into law, Representative Charles B. Rangel, former chair of the CDC and then chairman of the House Select Committee on Narcotics Abuse and Control, praised the law, especially the provision that established the drug czar, noting that now Congress and the American people will know who is in charge of dealing with the nation's drug crisis, because this individual will be responsible for developing and coordinating all aspects of our war on drugs. The racial bias
that's not my
thesis,
word. That was his word.
I know, direct quote. The racial bias thesis fails to explain why African-American lawmakers supported the Clinton administration's Violent Crime and Law Enforcement Act of 1994 that established the three strikes and you're out sentencing rules, expanded the death penalty for drug trafficking crimes, and eliminated federal funding for inmate education programs. The law also allocated $9.8 billion in federal funds for the construction of state prisons nationwide. The racial bias theses also does not explain why Eric Holder, the first African-American attorney general, initially opposed efforts to decriminalize drugs and downscale the war on drugs. In The New Jim Crow, Michelle Alexander argues that, in quotes, the fact that some black people endorse harsh responses to crime is best understood as a form of complicity with mass incarceration, not support for it, end quote. This Congressional Black Caucus, the Middle Class Oriented National Urban League, African American Church, and the Nation of Islam would hardly constitute some black people. They represent the backbone of the political, economic, and religious leadership of the African American community. Nevertheless, whether African American leaders were complicit with robust counter-narcotic legislation or directly supported such legislation, they were ultimately in agreement with the operations of the embedded corporatist drug enforcement regime. In response to the heroin and crack epidemics, African American leaders provided consensus for the Nixon, Reagan, and Clinton era drug war laws as a way to restore stability to communities plagued by drug addicts and terrorized by drug dealing gangs. But robust drug enforcement was also seen as a vehicle to attract corporate investment into their communities, to spur urban economic growth and development, which facilitated the problems now associated with gentrification of the inner cities. Page 12 from Dr. Bartolo's book. And I was a little taken aback just the amount of focus, because this Congressional Black Caucus and their support, Charles Rangel and some of their members' support of early drug laws, they pop up quite a bit in your book. Why their inclusion and repeatedly coming back to some of their enforcement of these laws?
You said why I included them?
They seem to pop up quite a bit in the book. Why were they included? It seems to be they are somewhat of a focus, their support for some of these crime laws that took place.
No. Well, did you read the book?
I just read a paragraph from it. I can read more.
No. Well, you need to read the whole theoretical section of what I mean by an embedded corporatist regime. If you read that, then you understand why they're included. A regime
answer
means
it for our audience
that
members
you have... Then. Yeah, a regime is that they are different actors whose decisions and their behavior and their interests, while all different, coalesce to create certain policies, and that's what we call a regime, right? So this is not something where people are forced to vote a certain way, but they vote in their own interests. But in doing so, they support corporate interests, larger corporate interests. That's what a regime is, and that is why I talk about the Congressional Black Caucus and the black community, because they're a part of a corporatist regime, whether they understand it or know it or not. And I think I've provided it. Empirical evidence to support that. So what is your you disagree with that?
Well, you
disagree with that.
You said they're a part of a corporatist regime?
Yes, they're part of a corporatist regime, yes, of drug enforcement.
But
what I call
is it a specific, I know you list a lot of different like elements like Halliburton and other corporate, like is it a specific corporation, or just can you give a little bit more detail?
No,
just
no.
Because they have consented.
That's what I said. It's a regime. It's a regime that is driven by corporations, not just Halliburton, but all of these corporations. Same thing, right? All of these corporations, Halliburton, oil companies, arms contractors, manufacturing companies, they all have different interests in supporting drug enforcement, okay? Quite different. But the coalescence of all of their interests all come together to support an agenda. That's what a regime is, right? In international relations, we talk about international regimes. We talk about international monetary regime. That's a regime that includes commercial banks. It includes, international financial institutions like the World Bank, the IMF, and so on. All of these actors that I just remember, that just talk about, they all have different missions. But in pursuing their work, they contribute to this overall thing we call a monetary regime, right? One scholar refers to regime as norms, rules, decision-making procedures around different actors' expectations converge around different issue area. It's the same concept now we're talking about, a drug enforcement regime, not just these individual corporations, but the way in which these individual corporations, how they operate, and the ways in which domestic political organizations like the Congressional Black Caucus, also political organizations in partner countries and different countries in the world that are fighting the drug war, all come together to create this regime. That's what I'm talking about. All come together to create this regime.
Okay. I guess I'm having difficulty because I don't see what's funny. I mean, a lot of people went to jail, right, behind the drug wars. Like, that impacts a lot of black people. A lot of black people die behind this, right? That's in your research too, right?
Yes. If you read the book and you go to the end of the book, I provide some statistical evidence that both blacks, when you look at the evidence for both blacks and whites, there's statistically no significant difference between blacks and whites that generate profit for this drug enforcement regime. No statistical difference.
Okay. There's still a lot of...
If you go to the end of the book.
Okay, still a lot of black people end up being victims of the text, but I am trying to speak. Now, I have allowed you to speak without interrupting you. I would like the same courtesy in return. Thank you. I was saying that just because I don't think it's funny, like just bringing up a point with the Congressional Black Caucus point specifically. I guess I have difficulty because I don't see exactly what they're in charge of. When you started talking about in your book, the Clinton administration and the George Bush administration, George W. Bush's administration that came through in 2000, controversially in his connection to the oil industry and all of that. Wow, I get it. Lots of money, lots of power to control international policy. I get it. You have lots of details about that. With the Congressional Black Caucus, I don't really see where Charles Rangel or Eleanor Holmes Norton, the late Congressman John Lewis just passed away. Karen Bass, she didn't even get the vice presidency spot. I don't really see where any members of the Congressional Black Congress are like in a power position, like they're in control of something, like, ooh, if you're trying to get this bill passed, or even in the book, right, you talk about one of the Senate committees, like they had a problem with some of the drug laws and said, I don't know, we might consider slashing, you know, $200 million from this budget. I don't know. And then they ultimately approve it. I don't see the Congressional Black Caucus with that type of authority. Like, President Trump disrespects them all the time. Like, what sort of power and authority does the Congressional Black Caucus command collectively or individually?
I don't know what else to, I don't know what else to say to you, other than if you have not written the book, I can't, explain to you these, you know, what I would consider to be, a complex theoretical concept in a radio program. I would just say, if you read the book, then, you know, we could talk about it. Okay, there's a, I think I've laid out the theory quite well and then provided the statistical evidence for that. It's not about Congressional Black Caucus being disrespected by President Trump or they don't, they're not in control of anything. The point is that they support drug enforcement legislation that is consistent with the agenda, the purpose of not only a drug war in the United States, but a global drug war that is driven by corporate interests. That's the point. So that makes them part of this larger regime. And it's not just the Congressional Black Caucus. There are other organizations that are part of it as well.
Okay, you read the book. I did read the book, and I've read portions from the book. You can encourage other folks to check out the book as well. He does have important information. But I do think that's a legitimate question, because I didn't see that in the book in terms of what power and influence the Congressional Black Caucus has. I did see where you cited specific members and their support of these drug laws over the years, and then even some of these folks saying that, wow, these did have some bad consequences, and you know, maybe we should rethink it.
Well, you asked a very good question, but I think the source of your question, I think you would understand it better if you read the theoretical sections, right? Like what you're reading to me, you're reading things that are part of a larger context, and if you miss the context, you won't understand.
Are you not willing to explain that for our listeners to maybe pique their interest if they want to read, for folks who maybe they missed out? You're not willing to give a little bit more detail in terms of what power, Duran, I mean exact details, right? Because the people, when they talk about President Trump or why, that's what I said. You said earlier there's a difference between white elites and non-white elites. And that's the point that I'm getting by teasing out some of these details. Mm-hmm. Give me some of the details with the, because does the Congressional Black Caucus, does that count as a non-white elite in your book? Because you didn't cite them. Do they count? They're members, I mean?
Well, they're certainly not members of what C. Wright Mills would consider to be the power elite. Absolutely not. But on the issue of drugs, what I've cited on the evidence I provided in the book, they behave in ways, whether they realize it or not, that support corporate elites, corporate agenda. And I don't blame them, right? I mean, the structure of capitalism in the United States is of such a way that, of course, they're going to support tough drug enforcement to keep their districts safe. But in doing so, they also end up supporting a corporate agenda. And that's what makes them part of a regime. That's, remember what I said. You know, you don't have to be in agreement with all of the members of a regime. The members of the regime could be pursuing their own independent interests, but in pursuing their own independent interests, it coalesces to support a corporate agenda. And that's what makes regimes so powerful, because no one has to beat you over the head to vote a certain way. By voting to support your own interests, what you think is right by you, you're ultimately going to support me. That's what a regime is.
I'm hopping back to the earlier report that we discussed about the CIA disruption of Jamaica and the documents you uncovered, what was happening in the 1970s with Manley's administration. And you write, months of interviews with a former member of U.S. President Jimmy Carter's foreign policy establishment and former members of Manley's government, many of whom were unaware of the various maneuvers of the CIA's covert operation against Manley's government. And it seems like this happens a lot, where a lot of black people, a lot of non-white people worldwide are not totally aware of things that are happening, and or maybe because they're not aware, they're a little bit confused about what's happening with regards to racism, white supremacy, how they might be being manipulated and what have you? Do you think it's possible that might have happened with some of the drug laws where they might not have understood?
Well, yes. I mean, you I agree with that. No, there certainly. I mean, if you talk to the to members of the Black Caucus and you know, and you say to them, "Hey, there's this guy, you know, Barlo said that you're part of this corporatist drug enforcement regime." They would probably react to that like the way you did. They would probably reject that, right? Because they're looking at this thing from their narrow constituency. You know, I'm representing my constituency. I'm trying to keep my constituency safe. But when you look at the bigger picture, in trying to keep their constituency safe, they're supporting a corporate agenda that is putting billions of dollars into the pockets of wealthy corporations. Many of them are controlled by a ruling economic elite. Most of them are white. And most of them manipulate non-white people to ensure that white supremacy is maintained not only in this country but in the world. So white supremacy, if you want to think about this in a bigger context, as the way you want to think about it as a global phenomenon, I do agree with you that white supremacy is a global phenomenon, at least in our historical time period. I don't know if it will be in the next 50 or 100 years, but certainly right now. But for white supremacy to perpetuate itself over the past couple of centuries, it needs to have a compliance and support of non-white people. That certainly is an historical fact. And I stand by the argument that when you look at white supremacy in that context, right, historically you cannot separate class, race from its class dimensions. You just, I guess you can, but but I think you'd be making a mistake and you wouldn't really understand it. And if you do separate class from race, what that means is that you'll never get rid of white supremacy, because to get rid of white supremacy, you're going to need coalitions with non-white people to tear it down. How do you build those coalitions? Well, you first build those coalitions by appealing to a lot of working class, poor, rural whites, that the same system that is terrorizing them.
Dr. Bartolo, I want to make sure I heard you correctly, because you started your sentence, you said you'll need coalitions of non-white people, and then you said you'll have to appeal to working class white people. So I just want to make sure I'm hearing you correctly. Do you mean we'll need coalitions or non-white people?
Yes, you need coalitions between non-white people and white people.
Okay.
And
okay,
other races of people. Okay. Yeah, you need coalitions of all races of people to tear that system down. And how do you build those coalitions? Well, you build those coalitions by letting people understand that the same system that is exploiting them is also exploiting non-white people. That it's that the root of our problem is not race. Race is what is used to divide us, but the root of our problem is economic exploitation by a few who happen to be white. That's what it is. And And while I say this, that is very hard because a lot of poor white people in this country, they don't want to have coalitions with black and brown people because they believe that maybe if I remain true to my race, I could be one of the few rich whites in the country. And it's a false illusion. That's never going to happen. And we're going to be stuck. We're going to be stuck in this dysfunctional and increasingly violent system unless we figure out a way of how, yes, we want to tear down white supremacy, but we tear down white supremacy by attacking its economic legs. That's the point that I'm getting. And its economic legs is class distinctions and class. At the root of white supremacy, by the way, I should add this, is class conflict. But the way in which class conflict is manifested in the United States in the context of white supremacy is that it's turned outward. So disaffected poor white people take out their frustrations for their disaffections on poor black people, on poor brown people, on poor immigrants who are also exploited by the same system. For me, the danger to simply put a color and say white supremacy is basically white people screwing over the rest of the world, in a very simplistic sense, yes, that is true, but in a more methodological, rigorous sense, it is not true because you're ignoring the immense class dimensions of that. And if you don't understand the class dimensions of that, then you can't change that system. You can't struggle against that system. You can't build a coalition to tear that system down. You can't.
Gotcha. I want to pause right there. Dr. Horace Bartolo, context of white supremacy. And again, that's why I say we normally ask that question again, and you just reaffirm. That's why I said that's fine. It's just important to make sure that we have that clear. You and I don't have the same conclusion about what the problem is. I have concluded it is a global system of white supremacy racism. You just said at the root of this is economics. It is about class conflict. That's not the conclusion that I've come to. No problem. Just make sure that we have that clear as we move forward. I don't think it's funny. I want to point that out because that's happened several times this evening.
I'm not laughing at all.
However, no, I do want to come back to ask. Because I didn't get an answer. When I asked you before, Eddie Ciega, is he a white person? He's not. You said he's a black person. Eddie Ciega? Am I looking at the right? Edward Ciega, the former prime minister of Jamaica, he just passed away in 2019.
Yes.
He's a black male. That's what you say?
No, he's Syrian. He's from Syrian descent.
He's Syrian. Okay. So is he classified as white or not white?
He would be classified as not white, I think. I don't know. Maybe you have a different definition for that.
I just saw him today. I'm just seeing him for the first time. Like, I'm just learning about him. When you mentioned it before, he came up in the context of non-white elites. And I was trying to say, like...
I chuckle, not because I'm trying to be disrespectful to you, my brother, but I chuckle because the way how you simplify what I try to explain is a much larger complex phenomena.
Well, now I'm just trying to get clarification about racial classification of Edward Ciega
You and I agree. You and I agree.
About what?
I do agree. I agree that there is. We could talk about a global system of white supremacy.
Oh, okay.
That's a fact.
On that, we do not agree with definition. On that, we do not agree with definition, and you've reaffirmed that repeatedly. So, and that's fine. Many people have their own definition, their own conceptualization of white supremacy racism. And that's fine. You just have a different conceptualization of it. No problem.
Can I just finish up? Because this is your show, and you're I don't want to talk over you. But so I completely agree with that. But what I'm adding to that is, yes, it is a system, a global system you could call white supremacy. It existed from as early as what, the 1600s. Colonialism was basically not because white people in Europe just simply wanted to colonize non-white people, okay? That's part of it. But they did it to extract economic resources from non-white people, okay? And so if you want to understand the totality of white supremacy, you have to also understand its economic dimensions. That's all that I'm saying.
Yes, sir.
You have to understand its economic dimensions, because its economic dimensions also has been used to co-opt a lot of black people into supporting its agenda.
Yes, sir.
We've seen this.
Repeat what I said before. I'm not aware of any non-white people in the known universe who can truthfully say they have not in any way, shape, form been so-called co-opted by the system of white supremacy racism. Important point that comes up all the time. B in Toronto, did you have a question for Dr. Bartolo?
Ooh.
Yes, thank you so much, Gus, and thank you to your guests for being on the program today. Just to answer your question, Gus, former Prime Minister Edward Siaga would have been considered white.
Okay.
Just as Norman Manley would have been considered white, just as Alexander Bustamante would have been considered white, because my family's origins are from Jamaica.
Okay, so we consider them white.
I just mentioned the former prime ministers, three of them that would have been considered as white.
Yes, I
Alexander
heard
Bustamante, Norman Manley,
yes,
and Edward Siaga.
Yes, I'm just asking you, though, caller.
So, if you can, so kindly, I'm just going to ask the question real quickly.
Yeah.
In terms of the economics, from what I'm hearing, it's economics that is the core issue. Is that correct?
It's not the core issue. It's the way in which economics interact with issues of race. It's the interaction.
All right. So then my question is, is race the core issue?
As I say again, it's the interaction of race and class. Interaction.
Okay. All right, so I understand the interaction of race and class, but the thing that I'm trying to get to is that in order for class to be determined, race first is determined. Is that not correct? And that's something that is not within our control.
I don't know if race has to be determined first or class. It depends on what you're trying to explain. Right.
Well,
what is the phenomenon that you're trying to explain?
Well, if you give me a moment, I'll be happy to explain.
Yes, go ahead.
If the white supremacists have compartmentalized the human society into different segments, whoever is going to be white, whoever is going to be black, whoever is going to be red, who's ever going to be yellow.
Mm-hmm.
They would have needed to make those distinctions first, because I didn't call myself black. The black community didn't call themselves black. It was the white, after they have pillaged, decided to compartmentalize the human society and separate themselves ultimately from the rest of the group by calling themselves white. So then from there, they would have then determined what the economic system would have been like, because then from there, they would realize that whatever spoils or whatever things that they've stolen from other communities, the best of the best would go to them, and then it would be a trickle-down effect. Would that not be correct?
Yes, I don't have any. I don't have any argument with you on that. But again,
it's not an argument; it's an insight.
Well, yes, I don't have any problems with your insights. I think you're correct, okay. But it's also it is also quite possible that what you're getting at is a cause and effect. You know, does race cause class or class cause race? I mean,
that's not what I'm saying at all. This is not a cause and effect. From what has been known, and there's lots of factors to back this up, because even if you go into different historical places such as Black Wall Street, where the Black community was doing the economics, then what ended up happening? The whites were coming in and literally bombing and committing genocide. There's many other places that have been like this where the Black community.
It's just true.
That it's hard for me to. I'm sorry, if I can just please finish. I just find that it's hard for me to understand that, you know, it's a cause and effect when it's really what the perpetrator has determined, and if they're not getting what they want, then they will destroy. If they're not getting what they want,
I'm trying to understand what you're saying. I'm not saying it's a cause and effect. I'm just simply trying to understand what the point that you're trying to make.
I'm just going based on your words that you're saying that it was a cause and effect between race and economics. I thought it was pretty clear in terms of the fact that the perpetrator is the white supremacist.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to communicate. It's really hard to.
Yeah. Go ahead.
May I please finish my point?
Yes.
Thank you.
If the
white supremacist is the perpetrator, and they're the ones that are determining that it is this segment is going to be white, this segment's going to be brown, this segment's going to be black, and whatever they choose, then they're also the ones that have created the society and are dictating as to who's going to get what resources. Being that the most and the best resources are being reserved for them. So they're the ones that are also determining the economics.
That I don't agree with.
Okay. Well, I guess we're in an impasse. DGQ. Thank you so much for your time.
Would you like me to respond and tell you why I don't agree with that? Your caller said white supremacy is the ones that determine the economics. That's just historically incorrect.
You said that's historical.
Long before Europeans colonized. Yes, long before Europeans colonized the non-white world, they started to develop economic structures.
Who's in control of economics right now? I think that's what she was getting at. Who's in control of economics right now in the known universe?
Well, yes. I mean, they're whites are in control of it. But to say that, but you see, I'm not talking about now, right? You know, I'm a scholar. I'm not thinking about now. I'm talking about how did we get to now, right? How did we get to now? So it is. That's why I said it's what she said is historically incorrect. Do whites control most of the economic power now? Absolutely. But is it true that they've always that they determine, and what you said, they shape the economic structure. No, long before whites dominated the world or colonized the world, they started to develop capitalist forms of production in Europe. In fact, it was some scholars would argue, Lenin, Hobson, and many others have theorized it. There's a whole literature on theories of imperialism that talks about one of the reasons why Europe colonized the non-white world was because of contradictions of capitalism in the European world. So we have to get, we have to be very careful how we just simply bandy around words like that.
I'm sorry to interject.
Can I finish, please? Most of the world today, the global economy today, is largely controlled by 25% of the world's population that operates in most of the countries that we call the OECD group of countries or the G7 group of countries, which are predominantly white. Of course, we have South Korea as a member of them, probably one of the few non-white countries, but they're mostly white today. But if you want to, but we can't just simply look at today. We have to understand, how did today happen? Where did today come from? Today came from somewhere. And if we can't understand the process, then we're certainly not in a position to talk about how we could change the future.
Okay, let's hold right there. B, did you want to get, I guess, your retort in before we move forward?
Yes, I do respectfully agree that if one doesn't understand the historical past, then one does not understand the future. I do completely agree with that. And this is why I definitely wanted to note that at no time was the question ever, did whites always control the power economically? That was never a question. I sense it may be a deflection of the actual historical facts. However, historically, as of what's leading up to today, is that with white supremacy, because they have dictated through day-to-day living and just the functions of everyday life, that they have also determined how much resources would be allocated, and thus making even the black community as the underclass, the permanent underclass globally. So that's all that I have to say at this point. There are historical facts, if the guest chooses to do a little more research on that. Thank you.
Much obliged. Well, Dr. Bartolo.
I agree exactly what she concluded there. If you look at other.
Right on. I don't want to stay on that because y'all went over that about the economics. Yes, got it. With COVID-19, I did want to make sure I got in a quick question while we had you. Have you paid attention to the COVID-19 response in Jamaica? I know they were talking about Hussein Bolt, unfortunately, testing positive and making sure that they go to contact tracing for folks who might have tested positive.
Yes, I've been following it up, yes.
I guess you still have relatives and such in Jamaica, I suspect. Is that true?
No relatives.
Oh man,
I was an only child. What my parents have been passed away.
Oh okay, my apologies. But I mean, still certainly connections to the island. I guess what's your thoughts on how they've responded thus far? It's certainly not a hot spot like here in the U.S. and some of the other places. What's your thoughts on how they've handled things there thus far?
Well, I'm not there, so I can't really give you it's just my opinion that it's worth as much as anyone. But from what I've heard from friends there, that they responded quickly. They shut down the country. They really try to emphasize social distance. I think what I've heard is that they located where the infection and the spread was coming from. It was coming from these call centers, and they shut those down quickly. But then it started to spread again because of the election that is coming up on November 3rd. And of course, you know, people are going out campaigning and probably not wearing masks, and so they're experiencing a spike. A country like Jamaica really they're not in a position to handle, you know, a pandemic that is just relentless in infection. So I hope that they figure out a way of, you know, campaigning and doing, you know, going through the democratic process, but at the same time, trying to keep people safe.
I know you're not there. Thank you for indulging me. But to your knowledge, do they have any of the, like what we've had here, people protesting and say, hey, you're shutting down the tourism industry and we need people coming to Montego Bay and all the rest of it. And this is silly and this is an overreaction and I'm not going to social distance. Have they had any of those type of protests and oppositions?
No, not to my knowledge. Not to my knowledge. Absolutely not. The people have been largely cooperative with what the authorities have asked them to do. There were protests in support of the protests here in the United States, with George, you know, certainly the killing of George Floyd. There were certainly protests. I think there might have been protests in front of the American embassy, if memory serves me right. I don't know if there will be protests again in front of the embassy concerning the recent killing of our African American of our brother in Wisconsin again. They might, but your listeners should know that yes, there were a couple of nights of protests standing in solidarity with the Floyd family in front of the U.S. Embassy.
Global protests, racism, white supremacy. I guess closer to home, you're on the faculty, Professor, University of Kentucky, Lexington. That's a big school. SEC school. I forgot they were having talks because they have a shutdown activities. Are you all doing remote learning, or what is the schedule going to look like for you teaching moving forward this fall?
Most of my classes are going to be remote. We have a system here where some classes will be face to face, but most classes, I think, are going, certainly going remote. The infections have been going up, since, students have come back. You know, we kind of expect that would happen. You know, students, you know, are having parties and in their off-campus housing and things like that. But that's the danger. But the university, you know, for their credit, they have really prepared for this. You know, they have testing stations throughout campus and various places where you could, you know, I just went on campus today just to get some books out of my office, and I was surprised to see that there are disinfectant dispensers all over the place. you most people on campus are wearing masks. In fact, you can't get into any of the buildings without a mask. So they're doing the best that they can, and I think under the circumstances, the administration has really done a good job trying to keep students safe. So, you know, that's the best that we could do. But it is really tough. I thought you were going to ask me about the racial dimensions of COVID-19 because, the question is of, there is a major disparity between the number of people of color being infected relative to whites, and everyone has recognized that, even the CDC has recognized that this is not simply a racial issue but a class issue. Again, the interconnections and the intersection and of race and class. And so this is what we're dealing with in this country, that yes, racism is alive, it is a global phenomenon, but the way we understand it, we also have to understand the class dimensions of it, because if we don't, we are not in a position to change the system that we have.
Right on. We will park it there. We have been chatting it up. University of Kentucky's Dr. Horace Bartolow. We discussed quite a number of different issues. His report dealing with the CIA destabilization of Jamaica. I encourage us to check out those archives. In fact, encourage us to subscribe to the National Security Archives so you can be updated and find out when they declassify documents. And then as well, discussing his book, Drug War Pathologies, Embedded Corporatism and U.S. Drug Enforcement in the Americas. Check out the book. Check out the report. I'm sure he'll have more research to come. Much obliged for sharing your view, even though different from ours, but much obliged for sharing your view. I have learned. Hopefully you'll enjoy and stay safe for your coming fall semester.
My brother, it is not that much different from yours, but if you say so, I accept it. You're my brother.
Much obliged. Enjoy your evening.
Yes, my brother. And thank you for inviting me on your show. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
The person who recommended you as a guest on the program, she got a hand up. Did you have a quick moment to get her question before you depart, sir?
Oh, sure.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely.
9-5.
I don't want to dominate all your time, but sure.
Let's see. 9-5. Whoops, I messed it up. 9401. 9401. Did you have a question for Dr. Bartolow?
Thank you. I kind of missed the portion of the show because it was no sound. Brother, what I want to ask you, Professor, do you think that racism exists in Jamaica?
If racism exists in Jamaica?
That's correct, yes.
Hello? Did you ask me if racism exists? Yes, I want to make sure I understood you. You asked me if racism exists in Jamaica?
That's correct, yes.
Yes, you know, I do. I do. But again, how do you, when you say racism, you're talking about white on black racism, right? I mean, for me, racism is always...
I don't use that term. I'm not white and black. I don't use that term.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you're talking about white supremacy. Well, yes. I do believe that white supremacy exists in Jamaica. In fact, when I was doing the Gleaner archives, I have evidence of even the propaganda about Manly in the Gleaner, they made these, what you call it, these cartoons that lampoon Manly. They were heavily white supremacist themes that you see in the United States and in other places. And the other thing about in Jamaica is, like everywhere else, you know, people of color unknowingly, they internalize white supremacy. I got to tell you, I, for example, if I'm in Jamaica and I'm in certain circles, people may not accept what I'm saying, but if a white person may come to Jamaica and say the same things, they're more likely to accept it. So, you know, this is what, you know, even Bob Marley used to sing about. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None of us but can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, because none of them can stop the time. Right? So white supremacy is how black people also internalize the assumptions that white supremacy make about us. Called self-hate, and we, as black people, we need to, you know, we need to love everybody, but we need to love ourselves more than we love other people, because there's a tendency amongst black people not to value ourselves, and we need to value ourselves, value our history, value our identity. And that, if you're asking me if that exists in Jamaica, absolutely, absolutely exists in Jamaica. I saw it when I was growing up, especially in the 70s. I certainly saw it. I certainly saw that.
Yeah, the last question I want to ask, I don't want to keep you guys too long, you know, to me, the article was about racism and white supremacy, because you're talking about how America was influencing Jamaican politics, but just from the article, I don't remember ever seeing that word racism or white supremacy, and I wanted to comment on why that was.
You want to comment on something, or you want me to comment on something?
No, I want you to comment on why the word racism or white supremacy was not included in that article, even though the article, that's what it was speaking about. The article was not talking about racism. That's if you could comment on that, if I'm making sense.
Or why the word white supremacy was not... Well, I don't know.
About white supremacy. Oh, okay.
Yes.
Do you think that, what you're talking about, was that or no? You didn't see a relation, or that was the actual subject.
I see white supremacy and racism as synonymous with each other. Yes. I see white supremacy and racism as synonymous. Right? Let me say it this way. White supremacy, you see, it is racist, right? It is racism. But in a very, if you look, think about it specifically, the way in which it was originally constructed. White supremacy created a hierarchy of race. It's an hierarchical structure, okay? I'm reading this book by, it's an old book. I'm just going back to it again. So actually a good book. It's by a historian called Michael Hunt. The title of it is Ideology and American Foreign Policy. And what he does in this book, he's a Yale professor, Yale historian. What he does in this book is talk about ideology, but is not political beliefs. It's talk ideology, the ideology of white supremacy, that is the belief of American foreign policy makers that white people occupy the top of the hierarchy of race, and below them are other races of people, and at the bottom of the rung is black people, African people, right? So that is what white supremacy is about. It's the hierarchical structuring of race, okay? And
the question, though, was why you didn't use the term racism or white supremacy in your article on the CIA's activity in Jamaica. I think that was the question specifically.
I didn't use it because the term itself did not have a contextual value for what I was talking about. But it is implied. It is certainly implied. I don't have to say white supremacy. It is implied. The fact that American policymakers needed to destabilize Manley, not because he was communist, but because his policies was empowering black people, is white supremacy. Because by empowering black people, you are upsetting the order, the hierarchical structure of white supremacy. So you don't have to use the word white supremacy as if it's a knee-jerk reaction. It is implied. It is implied in the article. The fact that it is not that he was communist, but because of black Jamaica exerting itself on the world, even in the third world, means that this black country is violating its position in this hierarchy of race.
That got your question, man.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
For sure. Stayed with us a little overtime to knock out a last question. Dr. Horace Bartolow with the University of Kentucky, hanging out with us this evening, giving us his thoughts, the system of racism, white supremacy, class, the whole dynamics, what's happening in Jamaica. Again, thank you so much for being generous with your time and insight. Keep the research coming. Thanks for sharing a bit of your Wednesday with us, sir.
Thank you for having me again, my brother.
Thank you so much. Take care.
You too, friend. Bye-bye.
Good evening. Context of white supremacy. We'll be here tomorrow, White Dog, study session number 6. We are creeping on the conclusion. Romaine Gary's White Dog, normal broadcast time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be here Friday, neutralizing workplace racism. 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, compensatory call-in. Saturday, normal broadcast time, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Whew. If you don't, what does Mr. Fuller say? If you don't understand racism, white supremacy, everything else that you do understand will only confuse you. He has that at the beginning of both books. There is a reason. I might be confused about all kinds of things. I say that all the time. I am still learning. However, I have come to a pretty firm conclusion with regards to global system, racism, white supremacy, some of those components in terms of what we heard in the interview. I hear so frequently. I guess the main thing would be the context of white supremacy was designed, engineered, focused on, interviewing white people, there is a reason for that. I said that to myself so many times. Our guest for this evening's program was recommended. Most of the guests that people recommend are not white. I'm generally not interested in speaking to non-white people, particularly the non-white people who white supremacy racism is not really a focus of what they talk about. If that's not their focus, if they don't have accurate information and accurate framework for how they contextualize white supremacy racism, I'm really disinterested in talking to them. Really disinterested. Like, we can argue with white people who want to say, oh, no, there's no race. We got class. You got poor white people in Appalachia. Bill Cosby, he's got $1 billion. Oprah Winfrey, she got $1 billion. I'd much rather have that discussion with a white person than a victim of racism, white supremacy, particularly because this sort of thing happens all the time where you have non-white people who will continue to say, oh, no, I agree with you. Racism exists, but class, see? They got class. They'll do lots of those different components where you say, it's fine. We have a different definition because I'm saying it's not class at all. The system of white supremacy, white people are a class to themselves. And in fact, this has come up repeatedly. When we have works like Vernelia Randall, Dying While Black, Harriet A. Washington, A Terrible Thing to Waste, where they have information that says, wait a minute, when they talk all this nonsense about class, the black people who are in the so-called middle class end up having health results that are the same as the white people that are in the poor class. That's what I mean. The black people that are in the so-called middle class end up having pollution worse than what they do to white people who are in the poor class. That's what I mean. That sort of data. If you could get enough money to where you get to a class as a non-white person where white supremacy racism is not a problem, that would be one thing. I am not aware of any non-white person where that's true. All of that is nonsense and confusion that has been greatly, and I mean bold face print, greatly endorsed by racists, white supremacists. We read all of that with Paul Robeson, all of that about communism and Marxism and our shrunken proletariat, the masses. Yes, we will get them to join arms with us. Yes, our white brethren. Malarkey, all of it. Let's see. Definition, I can only say that when the beginning of the program, we had tech difficulties. I was having difficulties even calling in. I had to dial repeatedly and call over and over and over. It wouldn't connect. It wouldn't connect. People couldn't even hear the audio. I think the archive should be pristine, but we had lots of audio trouble at the beginning. We got into the broadcast. Folks will be able to hear. He gave a really poignant anecdote about his parents being brutalized and even him forgetting about it. Repressed trauma of white supremacy racism. His parents go through all that and he even forgets about all of that. And pivot from that, we mentioned the article about the CIA's work in Jamaica. Excellent point. Racism, white supremacy is not even mentioned in that report. And it's not, as he said, that you got to go willy-nilly and scream white supremacy racism every sentence, although that would be apropos given what we have. But to not have that mentioned at all, racism, white supremacy doesn't come up at all when he says the crux of this CIA destabilization is prevent black empowerment, especially preventing black empowerment from spreading throughout the Caribbean, throughout the world. Wow. That might warrant putting that in a correct context. Particularly, that report was published this year. Like, it was published since after George Floyd was killed. Like, man, this is one in the same. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. I can only say most non-white people in the world, people have said Gus T is very critical of black people that write books where they are talking about racism, white supremacy. This is why, where you end up with books that are all about white supremacy, racism, reports, articles that are all about white supremacy, racism. it doesn't get framed that way at all. And in fact, it'll pivot to blaming black people. That is so painfully stale and common in the system of white supremacy. White people are to blame for that too, making sure our attention goes back to other victims. But that is painfully common. Bring that up all the time when we evaluate black. Got to stop to talk about Uncle Tom of the week. Nutritional Uncle Tom. Didn't we hear that one this year? It is painfully common in the system of racism. I brought all that up about the Congressional Black Caucus. You'll hear it in the archives. How do you write a book about the drug war and we keep pivoting to the Congressional Black Caucus? He kept saying, well, if you read the book, implying, well, you just didn't read the book. I didn't want to read the book. I could have stopped on page one. Once I got to page 12 and saw, like, wait a minute, the drug war, Charles Rangel, the Congressional Black Caucus is a component, is a cog in the drug war, not the system of white supremacy, but Charles Rangel and the Congressional Black Caucus. Like, come on. Come on. And that's why I said, when I keep asking, well, what are they in charge of exactly? And you can't even tell me any. What are they in charge? Like, what Charles Rangel, Eleanor Holmes Norton, the late Congressman John Lewis? What are they in charge of? Karen Bass? Oh, man, you had better do X, Y, and Z, or the Congressional Black Caucus is going to have you, boy, by the end of the day, they will have your goose cooked. What? What? Who runs in fear of the Congressional Black Caucus anywhere in the world? President Trump mocks them every other day. He said that doesn't mean it. If they are part of the power elite, you don't mock the power elite. That's my opinion. I could be wrong. Man, oh man. And he mentions them again. Let's see. Let's go a little bit further in his book. Where does he mention the Congressional Black Caucus again? Let's see. On this page 45. Corporate lobbies, corporate financing of congressional elections, elite networks that connect corporations to the federal government, and the strategic support of the Congressional Black Caucus for overseas drug enforcement function in concert to create a policy environment in which the drug enforcement regime facilitates the process of capital accumulation by ensuring the perennial increase in drug war funding, even when it's the wrong policy. The strategic support of the Congressional Black Caucus, are you telling me they're a key cog in the international drug empire? System of white supremacy, man. This type of thing happens all the time. The attention ends up deviating and focusing to black people. Now, he does talk about a lot of different themes in the book. But in my view, what you just heard in the past 2 hours already gives you an idea of what type of framework in terms of how this information is going to be presented. You have to have an accurate, solid understanding of white supremacy, racism to go into this book to try to see if you can dig out constructive information from the text, because the accurate framework is not going to be within the text. Not even true for the report, in my opinion. The CIA article, that's a whole different. There's a book, right, we talked about, Drug Pathologies, and then the report on the CIA. Same thing is going to be for that report as well, even though it's very small. Hearing background noise, shouldn't be beeping. Don't know where that's coming from. Let's see. That's why I encourage folks to mute their line if you're not speaking. Let's see. Bang, got that. Anywho, more interested in talking to white people. Definitely not interested in having quarrels, arguments with non-white people who just have a different view. If you think it's class, if you think there's a non-white elite, no problem. I would have nothing to say, be quiet, maybe ask questions. That's about it. But not into having arguments with non-white people who do not have, in my view, an accurate understanding of white supremacy, racism. And if we're talking about non-white elites, non-white accomplices in the system, we do not have an accurate, logical framework for white supremacy, racism. That's it. Let's see. Our person who recommended this guest I'm not sure. I guess you didn't get to hear because there was silence at the beginning. So it'll be in the archives. So you'll be able to hear the exchange. He did a lot of interrupting, too. I guess let me get that in, too. With non-white people, that is something that I have noted, where we will do a lot of interrupting, talking to other non-white people. We're not really looking to get an exchange of views. He gave very long-winded answers often. It would not be a direct answer to a question. Even when you just asked, why did you not use white supremacy racism in your report on the CIA destabilization in Jamaica? There wasn't even a direct answer to that. That's another one. Non-white people interrupting other non-white people to speak. I don't think we do all that interrupting and talking over when we talk to a white person, generally speaking. And not even being able to answer questions, to just say, well, if you read the book, that's lame and ridiculous. Even if I didn't read the book, you can't explain for the audience members to entice them to read. Just why didn't you use racism, white supremacy in the article? Why did you not use those words? It took about 10 minutes just to get to that. All this other talk about class and all the, that is a pattern. Victims of racism should monitor that in themselves and others. Answer questions efficiently. Answer the question, one. Answer the question. It should not be 10 minutes of talking and you still haven't answered the question. Answer the question efficiently. That doesn't mean that you can't give nuance, as they say. People say that nonsense all the time, that, oh, you're just oversimplifying it all. No, it means I can answer a question without taking 20 minutes, without having to be prompted. Oh, you asked me what I ate for dinner, and I've just been talking for the last 15 minutes about where I traveled this summer and what I think of George Bush's politics and all. Oh, I had asparagus for dinner. That's what I mean. Answer questions. White people do that sort of thing. They're practicing racism. They dump buckets of words on you and talk nonsense, and you have to try and reel them back in. Answer the question efficiently. Don't talk over other victims of racism. Even if you don't agree, you can hush and let them talk. He did a lot of interrupting with me in the first portion, and then it continued with other people as well. But the talking over, not answering questions, those are things to monitor. We're talking to victims who are not willing to be honest, logical about white supremacy racism. Caller who recommended Dr. Bartolo, did you have any thoughts on what you heard? The archive should be, you know, working.
Good evening, everyone. When I came, I came a bit late, and when I heard the conversation, I think he was talking to the caller in Toronto, and I could hear the interrupting, and it sounded a bit combative at times, and I'm like, oh, man, just guess that I was requested. I started feeling a bit, you know, I felt bad. I was like, oh, man, the guess that I requested is, wasn't a very good guest request. I appreciate you bringing him on the program, and I also apologize for the quality of my request. I will do better next time. Thank you.
No apologies for a recommendation. We, still learning. And I mean, hey, the information in the article about the CIA, now I can't speak for the book because she didn't say about that, but the article, man, if you have a correct framework for that, that is super important. And he didn't even bring out, if you go back, if you listen to the archives, ma'am, I mentioned that. We started talking about the CIA article. It took a while for me to even get to the definition question because I think I just asked him about, he grew up in Jamaica and he said yes, and he gave a long answer with a lot of detail, no problem, but I couldn't even get to the definition. That's why I said he gave a long, very long-winded answers regularly during the broadcast. When we try to pivot to the definition, and then he started talking about the CIA report, which is no problem. That's what I invited him to come talk about. He starts bringing that in, but he's not talking about the CIA does not want Jamaica or anybody there who is talking about black empowerment, and we especially do not want this to spread throughout the Caribbean. That's hugely important, especially to have that in the CIA declassified document. Like, wow. Matter of fact, make that the lead. CIA opposes black empowerment in the Caribbean. But that's not what he was talking about. He was talking about classism and Marxism and all the rest of it. I ended up reading from his report about black empowerment, then he gave more detail on it. But it's just like, He seems like someone where racism, white supremacy is not what he talks about. As you pointed out, he doesn't use that language in his report. He doesn't use that language in the book. In fact, he says racial bias is the language that he uses in the book, talking about the drug war internationally. So if white supremacy racism is not the typical focus that you have, if you focus on it from class or whatever you do from the university level, that's fine. But wow, when we're trying to have, you know, logical, accurate conversation about what is actually happening on the planet, it makes it very difficult to even speak, especially if we're going to deviate to non-white. We can't even get accurate information about racial classifications. He was talking about Eddie Siega. And he mentioned him first in the context of non-white elites in Jamaica. I asked him, I said, well, who are the non-white elites? Can you name some of these people? And he says Eddie Siega, and he names a few other folks. And I go and I look at a photograph. It's like, wow, this looks like a white person. Like, I'm not sure. Like, non-white, I'm not sure. Like, we can't even get, in my opinion, we can't even get correct, accurate about who the non-white people are. I guess we'll have to look, because B in Toronto said that she thinks Eddie Siega is classified as white. He said he was born in Syria and all the rest of it. To me, that would even be what they call problematic, might be suggesting that we're not following logic. If we're having a conversation about non-white elites in a system of white supremacy and our reference port is someone who might be classified as white, man, oh man. Confusion is lethal. The vast majority of non-white people in the known universe are extremely confused about white supremacy racism, confused and or unwilling, fearful about speaking honestly about white supremacy racism. Make sure I include that. White people exert a lot of direct, indirect pressure on us to not speak clearly and directly about this problem, to put in some class, put in some intersectionality. Find some other components so we do not make it that it is white supremacy racism. That is the system in the known universe. Let's see. B in Toronto, any thoughts? Again, the archives, I know we had tech issues. B in Toronto, did you have any comments, or are you just listening in?
Thank you so much. Yes, I do. I do want to humbly apologize to you, callers and listeners. I went off code. This was really hard to listen to, and it was really hard to listen to. It was really hard to be patient. So I need to reflect, recalibrate, and get back on code. So again, I really do apologize, and I do apologize to the guest for interrupting. Tested by patience, but I apologize, and we'll do better. To go back to former Prime Minister Edward Siaga. So his father is Lebanese, his mother is European and African ancestry mix. However, in Jamaica, there is the, if you're lighter than a brown paper bag, then you have access to white, therefore you're treated as white. And that's pretty much how Edward Siaga was treated. When he was the leader of the Jamaican Labor Party and was in connection with the CIA, that's where a lot of the guns and the drugs and other nefarious things were coming into Jamaica and really causing a lot of problems. Because they were up against, the JLP was up against the PNP, the People National Party, that Norman Manley, I believe, was a part of. Also another who had passed the brown paper bag test, in America would not have been considered as white. He would have been considered as mixed. In Canada, may be able to pass for white, but in Jamaica, he had access to white because he passed the brown paper bag test. I mean, there's so much articles. I remember my parents speaking about former Prime Minister Edward Tsiaga and how much of a thug, literally, how much of a thug he was because of the fact that there was just so much murder, so much violence. There was so much political upheaval when he was in power. And it came to the point where different places within the parishes would be set up as JLP and PNP sections, and there would be people murdered or hurt on both sides. There used to be tear gas. My mom would talk about how there would be tear gas thrown and how an elder woman had to take water, put it over a cloth and put it over her eyes because there was that much violence happening in Jamaica. So just to give it additional context, and this is stemming from white supremacy. So yes, thank you so much, and I leave the line.
No apology needed, or I guess, you know, if you feel like you want to. We all are, I guess, supposed to be looking for ways to work on our code and make improvements. Being patient with other victims is something that we do mention from time to time on the broadcast, making sure we're being patient with other black people. I guess that's maybe one reason. No apologies needed for recommending this guest, if that encourages folks to make sure they're being patient with other victims and how we speak to us and communicate with other victims. Let's see, retired firefighter, if you had comments you wanted to make sure to get in on the broadcast, should be with us as well.
Gotta be heard. Hello?
Hello? I can hear you.
Oh, we can hear you. We can hear you.
Oh, okay. I was just asking to myself, who came on the program? Who was the guest on the program tonight? Miss Kamala Harris? I'm hearing the excitement somewhat in a way where, you know, dissatisfaction in a sense. So I'm pretty sure the archive is going to have a level of interest. The only way that I ended up getting on online was I called Miss B a second time, and she informed me that she was on the program because myself and Thomas was having trouble. We can get in, but it would only be silence on the other end of the line, and I actually gave up on it. Thinking that it wasn't a program or the technical troubles were beyond anybody's means to fix it. But, so who was on the program?
Hello? Dr. Horace Bartlow. It'll be in the archives. He's a black male. Just a black male victim of racism. Yeah.
Okay. And it sounds like he did not, he abruptly left.
Nope, he stayed for the full broadcast.
Oh, he did? Oh, okay. Hmm. Okay. What was the subject matter?
I'm not doing a whole recount, right? It'll be in the archives. It was focused on Jamaica mostly, but yeah, it'll be in the archives.
Okay. Oh, it was that broad. Okay. I thought it was something, you know, centered that he was to basically speak on, but it was basically something pretty broad. Huh? Okay. Well, I guess it'd be interesting to listen to.
it'll be, I don't know. I won't say constructive. I won't even say interesting, but it should be working in the archives. If anything, it will again highlight why Mr. Fuller has on the very first page of every book. I said this before. If you don't understand racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works, everything else you understand will only confuse you. So another brilliant reminder why we start with that definition, had to work to get that in. But yes, make sure people do not understand or do not agree, have some sort of different way of conceptualizing white supremacy, racism, already lets you know you might be into some confusion.
What was his reaction to your meaning for the meaning of the word racism, white supremacy?
He is insistent. It'll be in the archives. Yes, all of the highlights. Yes, yes, it'll be there. Again, I won't say constructive. Make sure you don't get me on record with, I won't say constructive, but,
okay.
Yeah, it should be working. It should be working so the folks can check it out. I explained, I had difficulty dialing in and lots of tech issues. Once we did get rolling, I thought it was, being heard by all, and then it wasn't, but then we got that fixed so people were able to hear the final component of it. But hopefully the archives will be pristine.
Yeah. Okay. And I agree with you. The ladies who apologize, I don't think it's necessary that they, you know, should have to apologize for anything.
Working on the code, that's all. Working on the code. Everybody can work on being more patient with victims. Gusty, all of us can work on that one, see if we can do better there. Can't be challenging when victims do not necessarily agree, which is pretty frequent, and or you have victims who that's all I can keep saying. He did not agree that there was a system of racism. You will find many black people who say that racism is a problem, but then they don't think that that is the system. And he said that repeatedly. He said, I'm quoting directly, at the root is economics. Many victims of racism think that that is the case. So just be mindful of that again. If you don't understand racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works, everything else will confuse you. We will be here tomorrow, White Dog, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Romain Gary, wowee. We'll be here Friday, neutralizing workplace racism. Stokely Carmichael, I believe, has some connection to Jamaica as well. He has a great, well, I won't say great, but he has an anecdote in his autobiography, Ready for Revolution, where he talks about black prisoners being used to beat Fannie Lou Hamer. Unless I've been misinformed, that is accurate. I've heard that recounted many other times where whites in Mississippi, you got lots of black people in greater confinement. It's easy to go and grab 5, 10, 20 of them, whatever, and beat this here nigger woman. And if you don't want to do it, we'll beat you and just find some other black people to do it. No problem. You can use that and say, we got nigger accomplices. They're working. It's not about color. You could do that. As I said, you'll find lots of examples of black people being so-called accomplices working with racist white supremacists. That does not invalidate the system. Just trying to follow logic. With that, I think we nabbed all our folks who had hands up and such. Unless there was a final, 30-second comment folks need to get in before we conclude.
Are you outside, Jeff?
Yes, sir. Beautiful, sadder, beautiful.
Okay, it sounds like it in the background. I can hear, sounds in the background. Yeah.
Plane just went overhead.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else? We will be here tomorrow. Much obliged. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We will need our brain computer working at the maximum to solve this problem. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled. I would still recommend hunker down if possible. Let's try not to be doing too much, going out to the club and the mall and all that kicking it. It is not hang out and kick it time. If we can kind of be as I said, hunkering down, stay home, stay at your residence, stay safe. That might be best, given everything that is happening worldwide. If you got to go out, be vigilant. If it looks like any whites are getting hostile and aggressive, it is time to wrap things up. It is not about being out to make confrontations and all the rest of it. Save face, as they say. Get out of there. Escape immediately. If it looks unsafe, looks like any white people are getting hostile and aggressive, get out of there. All of that said, being sober, buckled if we're going out to travel, if you're driving, you're not on the cell phone, just doing as much as we can to be as safe as possible under extraordinary conditions of white terrorism worldwide. No name calling. No name calling. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.